Hello and welcome to the Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fosbero. This week's guest is trailblazing in the tech and media industry, aged just 30. Chris Deleisinger works on brand strategy and editorial for Google and has already been recognised for her amazing contribution. She was named one of Management Today's 35 Women Under 35, was selected in the Drum's 50 Under 30 Outstanding Women in Creative and Digital, and was awarded a Future Leaders Award by Wackel. Crystal, so nice to meet you today here in White City in London, and as it turns out, very much our hood.
Yeah, exactly. It's so nice to meet in West London, and it's such a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you for asking me.
Ah, it's a pleasure. Now, I'm a little bit in awe, I have to be honest, when somebody says they work for Google, because it is such a cool, iconic brand. You've got a big title, but give us a flavour, if you can, in layman's terms, of what that actually means and what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reality is I'm a very small cog in a very, very large machine. But what I am responsible for currently is the social media for Google UK. So I'm responsible for our Twitter account, and also I'm responsible for the Google Doodle. So occasionally when you go to search for something on the homepage, you will see a image above the search box or some text below the search box, and that all goes through my team. And then we also think about our tone of voice, our brand in the UK, and how that lives across all of the different products that we market in the UK.
What aspects of that role do you love most?
It's actually a relatively new role for me. So I moved into it at the start of COVID. And I think the two things that I love the most about it are, first of all, thinking about what the mood of the nation is on any given day. Our mission as a company is to be helpful. And so every day, in order to think about how we can be most helpful to people, what we start with in our morning editorial meeting is, what is the mood of the nation right now? What has been the latest government announcement? Are there any national days that we can celebrate? How are people feeling? And often it's quite a good opportunity to think about how you're feeling as an individual or as a team, and then question whether that's representative of how the UK is feeling, and draw upon all those different news sources, social media, the news, and just get a sense of how we might be most helpful to people. An example being, during lockdown, we were trying to put together playlists for how people could keep themselves entertained at home, or how people could help keep themselves fit at home through our YouTube playlists. Or there were some brilliant product innovations like 3D animals, whereby you could hold your phone up and a 3D shark would appear in your living room. Or I don't know if you remember, at the start of lockdown, Tiger King was very much of the cultural zeitgeist, and you could create a 3D tiger in your garden or in your living room. And all of those things, although they sound quite small, I guess they were small ways in which we would think about how we can contribute to helping people through what was quite a difficult time, and also do it in an inclusive way. So for example, let's not assume through what we say that everybody has a garden, for example, everyone has the space to do particular things, and instead think about, yeah, how we can be helpful to everyone. So that's one part, thinking about the mood of the nation. That's definitely something that I love about it. And second is really the team. I work with a phenomenal tribe of people, and hearing, you know, everything that they bring to the role every day is really what kind of gets me up. And actually, I guess more from a ways of working perspective, having this 10 o'clock editorial meeting every day allows us all to connect, have that regular touch point, which we're really missing and craving at the moment through working remotely. So yeah, they're definitely two of my favorite things.
We'll go back to the actual job itself, but you touched there on the team, because during lockdown, you built a virtual team. And in fact, you wrote a piece about that, on the ups and downs of it, on your LinkedIn profile. What were the key elements, do you think, of building a virtual team that made it work?
Well, whether it works or not, I don't know. We'll have to ask my actual team. But I think a few things are top of mind. One is that, you know, the brilliant equation that I think I referenced in that article, which is trust equals consistency over time. So showing up every single morning at that editorial meeting, cameras on, microphone on, being there and showing up every day. I think having that consistency is really important. I think there can sometimes be a tendency with virtual meetings to cancel last minute or move. And so keeping that as like sacred time that doesn't move, and knowing that you're there for the team to come together, is really important. Secondly, we regularly ask each other how we're doing, and I ask the team to score themselves out for how are you feeling today. So you can't really be on the fence with a score system of 1 to 4. And I think just, yeah, vulnerability is a word that's thrown around a lot within the corporate world and leadership books, but really reinforcing and reiterating that message every day that it's okay not to be okay. And that doesn't have to come with an assumption of exhaustion or negativity associated with it. But something that really struck me throughout lockdown was that different people would be on highs and lows on different days for different reasons. For some people, it might be an unwell relative. For somebody else, it might be the weather. For somebody else, it might be the news that we would be working from home for another few months. So I think trust, consistency, and vulnerability, and kind of practicing that is really important. And then another thing that I'm going to sneak in, which I didn't know about when I wrote that article, was that leaders need to leave loudly. And I think that advice is really powerful, especially as people are working longer and longer hours and finding it more difficult to detach from their desks at home. So what this concept means is basically when you're going on holiday or when you're going offline, make it very clear and loud that you're doing that, because you need to role model extra loudly that you're offline so that you're not accidentally setting that expectation that people might be working all hours. You know, a simple thing that I try to do is not send emails past a certain time at night, and I'll just schedule send them for, you know, 9 o'clock the next morning. Because I think we have a responsibility to make sure that the example that we're setting is a healthy and sustainable one for the teams that we're leading.
That does sound healthy and sustainable, because we are living in this 24/7 world. And I think I read recently, it might have been actually from one of your articles, that we receive more information in a day than our ancestors did in a year. How can we switch off a bit more and make sure that we're not just slaves to our emails and our phones and our social media as well?
I think it's a good question. I really don't know the answer. I'm currently taking a couple of weeks of holiday to try and do exactly that. Over the last few months, I feel like I've been on various sprints, and that's okay for kind of 6 or 8 week periods. But when you go from one intense period of working to another, I think it does have an impact on your creativity and your mental and physical health. At the start of lockdown, I was in a bit of a routine of going for a walk every day, listening to my favorite podcast. And over the last few months, that's completely fallen by the wayside. My screen time has gone up massively. And I found myself actually being bored by my own vocabulary, because I'm aware that I'm not reading or seeking news articles or looking at advertising that I would usually come across in a normal day. You know, even tube ads, for example, I think seeing things like that, seeing the way that words are being used, especially within my profession, is really inspiring. And I've really noticed that my sentence structure and vocabulary has become quite homogenous. So I'm on a personal mission this holiday to read a bit more and open my brain up and expose myself to things that I don't do in a usual course of the day.
One of the things that shocks me is at the end of the day, when your time on your phone pops up, and either I've got to behave a bit more or switch that off on the phone, because it horrifies me when it says 6 hours, 35 minutes, and you think, gosh, you know, probably about 10 or 15 minutes of that was proper work and the rest was me drifting around Instagram. But it does this thing when you're refreshing on something like Twitter or Instagram, it's like pulling the arm of a one-arm bandit. You're just waiting to see what else is coming up, and it's really, really addictive. So it must be difficult in your world, when social media is your world and you are feeling the mood of the nation, to actually switch off.
Yeah, it's something that I struggle with, Helen, as well, actually. And I'm off for the next couple of weeks, and my key goal is to read more and to expose myself to sources of content and news that I don't usually in my day to day. I think the analogy of the fruit machine or the one-armed bandit that you gave for social media is, I mean, it's what social media is designed to do, right? There, you do get that dopamine hit when your feed refreshes and you get new content. And I don't know if you've watched The Social Dilemma on Netflix, but it was absolutely fascinating. And I guess the thing that I took away from it is that there's so much incredible behavioral science and nudge theory behind product and product design, some of which is for good. And the other part of it is then, how can we be more intentional about our own usage? For example, I think I do mindlessly scroll through Instagram. Something that Chris, my husband, said to me the other day was that in the middle of an argument, if I'm frustrated by something, I just immediately pick up my phone and go to Instagram. So anyway, as I was saying, my mission over the next couple of weeks is just to read as much as possible. And, you know, even just, there's so much stuff that you miss out on through not working in an office, you know, the fashion that you see people wearing, the tube ads, all that kind of thing.
When you talked about the shark in the room, I mean, we did all that. I didn't do the tiger. I didn't know about the tiger, but I did do the shark in the room and enjoyed it. Are there days when you go home and you feel you really got the mood of the nation right, and are there other days where sometimes you think, don't know whether we were quite right? Is it quite a challenge, particularly at this time, to hit the right spot?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, it's quite a new role and it's something that we're doing in quite a different way, right? I don't want to overstate my actual role. When I say the mood of our nation, it's really through our Twitter channel. And that's something that we've been doing in a relatively new way. And the other thing I think about it is it's about knowing how Google can enter that conversation. So typically a way that I think we can play a really interesting role and helpful role to people is by showing what the UK has been searching for. So throughout lockdown, there were some brilliant, very funny, honest, touching things that the search trends, which are publicly available to anybody for the UK, were, you know, quite hilarious. So there was a period of time where the top most searched question about COVID was, who is Gemma Collins in isolation with? And there were other ones, you know, which was like, how to make a quarantini, how to make banana bread, how to de-stress. And actually, often we enter the conversation through our product, right? I think that's where Google can be helpful, especially if you think about some of the more difficult times over the last few months. For example, the tragic murder of George Floyd. During that time, searches for how can I be anti-racist as a white person? How can I use my privilege to be anti-racist? Those kind of questions were coming up. And so actually, through the lens of what people are searching for, so search queries, as I said, all of which is publicly available, it gives you a really good sense of how people are feeling at a given point in time and really like charts that time as to how people are feeling throughout lockdown.
In your previous world before lockdown and your new world, marketing, strategy, they were all sort of very much what you were doing. It's all about people, isn't it? You're a people person, aren't you? And I suppose it doesn't really matter what sort of media or tech words are in the title. I can sense that for you, it really is about individuals and people.
Yeah, for me, the number one skill for succeeding in the modern workplace or any workplace really is empathy. And I think that sits across any industry or role that you're in. And really, it's about going out of your way to understand views that are different to your own. That can be speaking to somebody who doesn't look like you within the office to understand how something may or may not impact them, or somebody from a completely different industry. I think the more that people can sidestep worlds is pretty crucial to make sure that whatever it is that you're trying to do is fully representative and inclusive of opinions that are different and divergent to your own thinking. So I really admire people who will go out of the way to speak to people who they know have a different opinion to their own, to make sure that the project that they are trying to complete is able to kind of take into consideration concerns that the harshest critic might have. It doesn't necessarily mean that you change your product or your project, but having an awareness of that, I think, is crucial. And to me, empathy has been the skill that, whether it's been in consulting or in my marketing roles, has, I think, set me up in good stead because it's often forgotten about.
You're a very warm, approachable person. How would you describe your leadership style?
So I would describe my leadership style probably in three ways: empathetic, purpose-led, and fearless. Empathetic for all the reasons that we previously discussed. I think it's so important to understand different people's viewpoints and have that ability to connect with them to be a great leader. Purpose-driven because I think it's so important for leaders to always start with the why. Often within strategy or just generally within projects or big corporates, we get so stuck straight into the how are we going to deliver this as opposed to why are we doing it. And I think if you can nail that purpose and always begin with, I'm asking you to do this thing and here's why, it really helps bring people on the journey that you're trying to go on. And then thirdly, I would say fearless because I think from quite a young age, I've always just thought, what's the worst that can happen? You know, it's better to take risks and see what happens than to not take those risks at all. So I guess I try to be as pirate as I can.
No, and your first one was the empathetic. And I think your husband describes you as a bit of a magic maker, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. He does actually. And it's a very nice thing for him to say. What's the point of going through life kind of just settling for mediocrity or average, you know, where you can try to spark joy for people, for your team? Like, I always try to think about how I can bring a bit of joy to people's life, whether it's sending an email in a particular way. I just, as I said, I'm on holiday now and I wrote a handover poem because, you know, like, why not? It doesn't take any extra effort, or for me at least. I mean, for other people, they would paint something or put together an equation, but words come to me very easily. So I wrote a very quick handover poem and I just thought, why not? Why do something bland when you can spark joy for people? So I think that's probably where the magic maker component comes.
For those listening, they won't know that we've just moved rooms because of some building works going on. And in one of your less pithy responses to your leadership style, I did love your explanation of being more pirate. Just can you expound on that for us a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. So Be More Pirate is a book written by a very dear friend of mine called Sam Conniff. The concept underpinning Be More Pirate is that you should go about trying to positively f- things up and drive positive change. And I totally subscribe to that. Something that Sam says in his books and in his workshops is if you feel like you're about to get fired, you're probably doing it right. And often the things that hold us back from driving great change or from challenging the way things are is some combination of fear and admin, which are really quite bad excuses why not to do something. You know, we've all been in those situations where we could put our hand up and try and change something that we know doesn't really make sense. But then when you realize that you have to have 10 meetings with different functions to try and get everyone to agree about this change, it can be slightly crushing. And sometimes you just have to take more dramatic action and direct action. And maybe sometimes it is just sending that email to the CEO or saying what you think and putting your initials against it and running towards that target. And that can sound quite glamorous. I think the reality is that it can be horrible. You can feel like you're putting yourself at risk, not a kind of personal risk, but I guess professional risk. And uncertainty and risk never feels great. Although I think we kind of love this idea of everyone being like super high risk, having a super high risk tolerance, but actually it can feel quite scary when you worry whether the thing that you're doing is going to get you fired or not. So that's the basic idea. And the premise is one of the R's that he talks about, because obviously a book about pirates has to be filled with R's, is weaponizing stories, retelling stories. And if you think about the pirates, they were the kind of first super brand before Coca-Cola had its kind of iconic glass bottle. And their brand was the Skull and Crossbones. And everyone knew that and they had no marketing budget. And so I guess that to me is something that I think about on that point around magic making or sparking joy. Making sure that everything that you do has a really clear visual identity, that you're allowing people to really understand your brand and your image and conveying those core messages that you're trying to tell. So Be More Pirate is about causing good trouble and not letting fear and admin get in your way.
I'm going to be a lot more pirate, I think. I'm also going to take a list of reading from you, and you've obviously spent a lot of time thinking about all of this. It feels really inspiring. You touched on having a fantastic education there. And in the podcasts I've recorded so far, there's often been a personal link to the guest. And this time it's that you went to the same school as my 16-year-old daughter goes to. Tell me about your parents and your upbringing and how determined they were to make sure that they gave you a really great start in life and a fantastic education.
Yeah, I mean, I think my purpose in life is so directly linked to my parents and the education that they gave me. Both of my parents are from working class backgrounds. My dad's a builder, or he was a builder. He's retired now. My mum worked at BA for, I think, about 42 years and actually just got made redundant in the latest kind of wave of redundancies from BA. But really, my mum was so adamant that education was the kind of key to setting us up for success. And I guess underlying that was an idea that she never wanted kind of us to have to work as hard as her and my dad did. So they did everything they could, saved, kind of didn't spend any money on themselves or holidays or anything to really put my brother and I through a private education, which was the way that they felt they could give us a step up in life. And so really my purpose and the thing that drives me forward is the fact that I don't think I'll ever be able to repay them for the amount of hours and night shifts and everything they sacrificed to be able to afford that education for my brother and I. And I think at the time I look back and cringe sometimes, right? Because like, I think there were definitely times where I was really embarrassed that my dad would be like, you know, the only van behind a row of Jaguars and Range Rovers parked outside the school, which I didn't realize what a big deal it was at the time. But as I've grown older, I now realize what a precious gift that was and what a sacrifice it was for them to be able to afford and choose to do that with their money, basically. So yes, it's very precious to me, and I had an incredible time at Godolphin.
You speak at a lot of events these days, but you were pretty shy of all that in primary school, weren't you? I'm thinking, head in the actual desk.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about that and how Mum really encouraged you to get out there and feel confident speaking to people.
Yeah, well, this is definitely the best researched interview I've ever done. So thank you so much for taking the time to go through that. It's a true skill and I really appreciate the time you've taken to
make sure we leave that in the edit, obviously.
Yes. So when I was at primary school, my English teacher at the time, Mrs. Stanley Carroll, asked me to recite Daffodils in front of the class. And there were only about 15 people in the class, so it wasn't a particularly large deal. But I did put my head in the kind of old school Victorian tray desk because I was so shy. And from that point onwards, my mum really encouraged me to, you know, take up debating and public speaking. And I guess actually there's a kind of deeper point there, which is from that comes a core belief of mine, which is that anything that you want to do, you can achieve through really hard work, right? Like, I don't think I'm naturally gifted at maths, but I know that if I worked hard enough, I have full confidence that I could get a PhD in some form of mathematics or quantum physics if I applied myself. And I guess that journey that I went on, obviously not realizing at the time, from being kind of chronically shy, terrible public speaker, to someone who's confident, or at least I'm confident enough to make my way now, sits in my belief that you can learn what you need to succeed in whatever industry that you want to be in.
I remember a similar cringe-real moment from my days at school when I was about 15 doing English literature and being asked to stand up in front of the class and read a passage from Chaucer. That sort of was okay, but the passage they'd given me was the rude bit where somebody puts their bottom out of a window and somebody else climbs up. And I was just absolutely mortified at the whole thing. I mean, I did end up being a broadcaster, which is great. I think we had the same ambition, actually, to present Woman's Hour on Radio 4. Neither of us have done that yet.
Not yet.
I think we're going to be more pirate and maybe we'll have our own show on Radio 4 at some point.
Yeah.
But like me this year and since lockdown, you have become a podcaster. Tell me about your podcast and the title and the essence of it.
Yeah, so I am the co-host of a podcast called Greater Than 11%. And Renee Vaughan Sutherland, who created the podcast and the whole idea herself, who I have to give full credit to. The insight behind Greater Than 11% is that only 11% of creative directors in the UK are women. And that is a really depressing and shocking stat. So my brilliant co-host and the founder of Greater Than 11% said, I need to do something about it. And she set herself this mission of speaking to a brilliant woman every week and doing a podcast about it, based on the idea that if you can't see it, you can't be it. So you could extend that to hearing it. If you can't hear about it, then you can't be it. And she is a true, in my opinion, capital C creative. You know, she interviews people from costume cutters to artists to sculptors. And really, the mission is to increase diversity within the creative industries. And part of that is showing what people can be and actually what the core skills are involved on a day-to-day basis of those roles. Because unfortunately, publications like, you know, the Times 100 careers booklets are paid by big corporates who can afford to have their pages included within it. And I didn't even know that marketing was a job when I left school or university. That's why I went into consulting. I just didn't know that marketing was a thing. And maybe that just shows kind of my own naivety, but I think the creative industries need more diversity within them and find out about what does it actually mean. You know, what does a producer actually mean? What does an editor actually mean? I think it can be quite confusing for people. So she created it and she has published a zine. She has lots of articles. And then she interviewed me 1 month. And then we talked about this ambition of being Women's Hours presenters. And then she was like, why don't you come on board? And so I started a monthly panel whereby we'd do a kind of roundup of what had happened that week and take a slightly more informal, lighthearted approach to the podcast. And yeah, that's been, I think we're just wrapping up series two now.
That sounds fantastic. Also, I was shocked to learn that there are more CEOs named David than there are female CEOs. How can we champion women more and get more women at executive level and in top jobs and perhaps give them the confidence to break through the glass ceiling that does seem to still be there?
Well, I think we do need to have representative boards, and currently we don't. as evidenced by that data point that you just suggested. So I actually think it's really not on women to have more confidence to smash through that ceiling anymore. It's that space needs to be made at the top. So maybe companies need to sign some big checks to politely ask people to leave and go on brilliant holidays for a very long time so that all of the wonderful talent that is sitting there, you know, women are, you know, leaning in so far that they're practically horizontal at this point. I mean, even I think if you look at US politics right now, the fact that the two front runners for the president of the United States are over 70, not that there's anything wrong with being over 70, but is there really no talent that sits below that, which could also be a kind of viable option to be the leader of the free world? Like, it's just depressing. So honestly, I don't know, right? I'm sick of the onus being on women to like be more assertive or do some public speaking training or be more confident. I think there are so many brilliant women and men out there who can offer so much to the workplaces, but it feels like the upper layers of management in a lot of these places are quite stagnant and difficult to move. And I think that kind of that needs to change. People need to be encouraged to kind of rotate and move around. And I guess the counterweight to my be more pirate side of things is that, you know, there are very senior people who have families to support and, you know, what jobs might they go on to next? But I think until we think of a good solution to, I don't know, the length of working lives that people will have these days, I just don't really see, this sounds very depressing, but it's just something that I've thought about a lot. You know, I'm surrounded by absolutely phenomenal people. They're not the leaders of businesses, right? So I think everyone's just a bit like, when is this going to happen? Like, when are these people going to rise through and become the leaders that they need to be? Something I would say is that you don't have to be a CEO to be a leader, right? And I think that's, if you define leadership as anyone who has influence over another person, that's something that I talk to my team about a lot, which is you don't have to be managing large teams to be a leader. You can do it through the way that you influence people, influence networks. You know, you look at people like Greta and lots of big movements that have started through people at the fringes connecting and deciding to make a change. And that's where power is being more redistributed. So maybe we need to kind of think beyond the traditional structures of hierarchy. But honestly, I don't know. And it's something that I find incredibly frustrating and depressing.
We spoke to Patrick Hutchinson a week or two ago, the man who rescued the white counter-protester from the Black Lives Matter protest. And that just one image of him carrying the man to safety has given him a whole platform now to launch UKAI, which is United to Change and Inspire. And the movement that's behind that now, just because that one kind gesture happened to be captured in a very powerful photograph, I think is really inspiring. One thing I did want to ask you, which is a bit sort of left of field, but when you did land the role at Google, was there that absolute bubble of excitement that you were going to work for such an iconic brand?
Yeah, I think there definitely was. You know, I'm incredibly proud to work at Google. And actually, my mum is so obsessed with Google. So of all of the things that cause the excitement, she is obsessed with technology. She is a kind of keen observer of the technology industry and particularly Google. She's kind of constantly in awe of what Google is doing. And last year, I was fortunate enough to be able to give her a tour of the headquarters in Mountain View, which was really special for us. So yeah, there was definitely that bubble of excitement, and the people that I'm lucky enough to work with are excellent. And I do believe that we are trying to genuinely be helpful. So it's great to work for a business where you do feel like that goal is at the core. It's a privilege to work for a company of Google size where you do feel like being helpful is at the heart of everything that we're trying to achieve.
So when you did get the job, did you have like a bit of a clothes dilemma thinking, gosh, you know, do I go in trainers? Do I go uber cool? Do I go more sort of jacket and suit?
Yeah, it's a great question because I think I was quite naive when I joined Google to think that it was truly a kind of casual environment. So if anything, having been in a very corporate consulting world, I then took that to the other extreme. And I think what I realized is that going back to that point that I kind of talk about a lot in general, which is that every signal that you send out into the world from your laptop or your notepad or your clothes or the vocabulary that you use, they all send signals about who you are. Whether you want them to or not, they leak information about who you are. And I think for my first year at Google, I was so excited about not having to kind of wear the 1,000 shades of black that I had in my wardrobe, that I dressed too casually. And I think probably being young within the business and then dressing as casually as I was, not inappropriately, just to kind of caveat that, but just casually, probably undermined my credibility a little bit, or meant that I had to go above and beyond to show that I was credible and could be taken seriously. So yeah, something that I've actually just been writing quite a bit about is this amazing quote, the "Thank You for Reminding Me of It" by Marc Jacobs, which is kind of dress for the weather that you want, not the weather that you have. And I apply that to work, you know, dress for the job that you want, not the job that you have. And I guess what I started to see within Google was a slight uniform appearing within the leaders of the business. You know, for the men, it was jeans, shirt and a jacket. And for women, it would be quite like statement, very well dressed, a very specific kind of smart casual. And I think from that moment, I moved role from my first role at Google into my second one. And at that moment, I decided that I was going to dress much more formally than I needed to. And actually for myself, not for anybody else, I was kind of, yeah, wearing jackets, wearing heels, because it made me feel more credible in a room where, yeah, I was often the youngest person or the only female or one of fewer females, for example. So I'd now take dressing much more seriously. I think it's about intentionality, right? Like, I will never say to somebody, you should wear red because red emits power, or you should wear high heels because the height gives you power. It's just be conscious of who you are and how you want to show up, and then make sure that everything that you're showing to the world points in that direction. And for me, I think what you wear is a key expression of that. So I'm a lot more intentional about that now. But that's not to say that there's a homogeneity to successful dressing. I don't really believe in that.
I love the fact we're both in our trainers today and very, very casual. That is the beauty of a podcast. You said that you've been writing. What are you writing at the minute?
I just submitted a book proposal for something that's been in the back of my head for probably the last at least 5 years, maybe more actually, maybe more like 8, which sounds incredibly embarrassing, to be honest, which is a book called How to Lean In When You're Not the COO of Facebook. So as I mentioned, I think Sheryl Sandberg is incredible. Lean In honestly kind of influenced my career more than anything, any other force, any training that I went to. That book was really pivotal for me. As I've revisited it over time, something that struck me is that there's quite a lot of assumed seniority within Lean In as a publication, right? Like, Sheryl starts the book by saying that when she was heavily pregnant, she walked into Mark Zuckerberg's office and demanded a parking space outside the office. And I think, you know, good for her that she did that. And I genuinely have no bad words to say about Lean In. I think it's incredible. But I think that there's a level of impact that she could have because she was so senior within that business. Many of the things that we've talked about, being fearless, being empathetic, taking risks, how you dress, there are so many things that I wish I'd have known kind of to help me through that first 5 to 8 years of my career before I kind of got a bit more confident in who I was and how I wanted to be. So I want to kind of chronicle that and write down, here's how to survive when you don't have an assistant or a secretary to help plan your life, and you can't afford perhaps childcare, and you can't go and walk into Mark Zuckerberg's office, but you're just trying to live and work and not give up, basically.
I'm just wondering whether there are sort of perhaps 3 books and a podcast or a small list like that that maybe you could recommend to our podcast listeners.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess if I had to recommend the top 3 books for me, I guess, which speak to a lot of the concepts that we've talked about today, one would be Be More Pirate by Sam Conniff. And actually the follow on to that book, which is How to Be More Pirate, which is more of a pirate's guide, by Alex Barker and Sam Conniff. And I contributed to that book as well, so it's very dear to my heart. The second one would be the Marie Kondo book, The Joy of Housekeeping, I think it's called. Sparking Joy, I don't know. Because I think it's a really good maxim for life. You know, don't spend time with people that don't spark joy for you. By the way, I think sometimes this can be trivialized in the news a little bit to just mean, you know, unicorns and glitter. But actually, an example that Marie Kondo uses in her book is that a baby monitor can spark joy because of the utility that it provides in knowing that your children are safe. So joy doesn't always have to be frivolous, superfluous things. They can spark joy in their like inherent utility, and that's okay as well. So I hold that quite true for most of life. So I'd recommend that. And then thirdly, a book called Daring Greatly by Brené Brown, because she talks a lot about how it takes a lot of courage to dare, to be brave, to be vulnerable. Her definition of vulnerability, I think, is risk and emotional exposure and one other. And I think it's really important for us to all remember that challenging the status quo is not glamorous. It can feel really hard, and the anxiety that you feel through sticking your head above the parapet is uncomfortable and they cause sleepless nights. And often you just talk about the triumphs of them once they've been done. And sometimes it fails, but it's important to try, right? And if you fail, at least you kind of go out knowing that you tried. So they would be my three book recommendations. And then a podcast that I love is a podcast called The Squiggly Careers Podcast by Helen Tupper and Sarah Ellis. Their mission is to make work better for everyone. And I think they're just brilliant to hear about personal development, how you think about your career goals, how you can be more intentional about your values and your super strengths and feedback. And so I put into action a lot of their tips in my day-to-day life.
And let's end on somebody you hosted a year ago. You hosted the world's number one keynote speaker, really, who's helped people like Bill Clinton and Colin Powell, René Carreol. What was he like? And did you feel a bit nervous about interviewing him? Or
do you know what? René and I met when we both had absolutely streaming colds. So we actually bonded over the fact that we were both about to go on stage together. And I said, you know what, should I run across the road and get us some Lemsip? Because neither of us were in a particularly good shape. So I did run across the road. We didn't really have that much time together before other than bonding over the fact that we both felt awful. And then I think we were both buoyed up by incredible drugs that are in Lemsip and adrenaline on stage. And I don't know, sometimes you just feel an instant chemistry and connection with somebody. And René is just somebody who I draw a lot of personal strength from, and his book Spike is all about harnessing your superpowers. He interviewed hundreds of business leaders and political leaders from across the world. And the key insight from his book is really that all rounders are great, but actually being a great leader is understanding different people's super strengths or superpowers and assembling the people who you need to, rather than looking for all of those skills in one person. So it's all about assembling great teams. And I think, you know, even within the context of school, there's such a focus on being good at everything. But actually, what a relief it might be to say, what is your superpower and how are you going to really spend the 1,000 hours on making that superpower even better, rather than the 1,000 hours distributed around lots of different things that probably means that you're not going to be the best at that thing. And obviously, you need an assumed level of competence across, you know, math, sciences, et cetera, et cetera. But I just think there's an inherent bravery with saying, do you know what? I'm actually not very good at this. And if you're looking for this skill set, if you're looking for somebody who's super analytical within a role and super detail orientated and going to implement loads of new processes, I'm actually not the right person for you. If you want someone who's going to drive incredible digital transformation and vision and rethink about your brand in lots of different ways and drive change within your organization, there's no one better that you could hire than me. Right. And that takes kind of time and bravery, but I think it's quite freeing that people should get into the habit of saying it's quite an un-British thing to talk about being a superpower. But actually, I found it quite liberating. And that is what René talks about a lot. And he's amazing. So I hope you get to speak to him at some point.
Chris, it's been a pleasure chatting to you today. I'm so glad you made time for the podcast. And I know that you're on holiday now. And I just really hope that you're going to be horizontal for a little bit and get some time to chill. Do you think you will have time to chill now?
Yes, definitely. I'm turning off all emails. I went to Waterstones yesterday and bought a stack of books, and I will be listening to podcasts again. We both mentioned that maybe we'd struggled a little bit to read as much as we usually do during lockdown. And so for me, I really need to try and find my creative mojo again, because I've definitely noticed that I've lost it over the last few weeks and months. So that is my main goal. And also puppy training, because I've got a new little puppy called Alfie, and my goal for him will be trying to make sure that he learns to wee outside the house. So, you know, they're the lofty goals that I've set for myself.
That is a lofty goal to set for yourself. And I really hope he achieves that in your holiday time, and that you can put your cape away for a week or so and concentrate on him. So thanks again, Chris. I've really enjoyed it. You've really inspired me and motivated me. So many, many thanks. You've been listening to Crystal Eisinger, brand strategy and editorial for Google, and now puppy trainer. I'll be back next week with another inspiring guest. I hope you've enjoyed Crystal's conversation as much as I have. Do recommend The Convex Conversation to friends and family. You can download other episodes at convex.podbean.com or find us on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, and YouTube. There's a wide range of interviewees to choose from. Thanks very much for your company today. I'll see you soon. Bye for now.